Welcome to a special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review, brought to you by the Salem Media Group. I'm your host, Hugh Hewitt. Amidst the holiday travel schedule and the annual speculation over whether Americans are traveling more or less, shopping more or less than last year, we've taken a step back in this week's journal to talk about the origins of the Thanksgiving holiday itself. Thanksgiving is the least corrupted of the major holidays. It seems to have retained its essential spirit, untainted, or at least not completely distorted by the forces of commercialization and secularization. Yet the historical origins of the pilgrims and the nature of those particular immigrants remains, for too many, a subject they know little about. My friend and Salem radio colleague Michael Medved has done yeoman's work with a special program originally done for his own Michael Medved show. In this season of Thanksgiving, we'll go to Michael for a historical look at the separatists, the pilgrims, the Puritans, and the historical context that gave rise to Thanksgiving.
What is it about the pilgrims? We all know something about them. Everybody's studied the Thanksgiving holiday, which focuses on the pilgrims. But why do we pay so much attention to them? I mean, their situation is about as dramatic as it could be. No question about that. And they were remarkable people, but think about it. The colony they started, Plymouth, I mean, it really never got to be very significant. Got swallowed up in the much larger colony of Massachusetts in 1691. They were always viewed as irrelevant, weird, different. They didn't start a college. The Massachusetts colony did. That college was called Harvard. The Pilgrims never became rich, never became particularly influential. And in fact, William Bradford, who wrote so much about the founding of Plymouth Colony and this adventure going across the sea in the Mayflower and landing, some say, on Plymouth Rock, William Bradford, at the end of his life, thought everything they had done had been a failure. So why do we spend so much time on these people? They weren't the first to come to North America. There had been a colony at Jamestown, planted some 13 years before. Remember that colony with Captain John Smith and Pocahontas? And what about those Puritans nearby? We tend to confuse Pilgrims and Puritans. What were the differences? Why do the Puritans, who were so much more numerous, so much more successful and influential, tend to get such a bad reputation in the history books, certainly in popular culture, whereas the Pilgrims we think of as pretty wonderful? Were they? What about their experience makes them so worthy of attention? These are some of the questions that I want to deal with today. The holiday of Thanksgiving has been attacked recently because supposedly it represents all kinds of evil deeds involving evil Europeans who did nothing but decimate and abuse Native Americans. Some people have even suggested that the holiday of Thanksgiving ought to become a feast of penance to Native Americans. Does that make sense? Or is there a deeper reason and a more important message that we ought to take from the holiday? All of that we want to cover on a very special show today, looking at the real story behind Thanksgiving and behind the Pilgrims. First of all, you've got to understand something about what was going on in England at the time. England had just a few years before emerged from a dire threat that most Englishmen, particularly Protestant Englishmen, thought might represent the end of their world. That was the Spanish Armada. That was 1588, Spain, the big power on earth. And all of a sudden, through miraculous intervention, a lot of it involving very turbulent and unpredictable seas, the Spaniards are defeated, the English are riding high. But meanwhile, all kinds of disputes break out about the English Church, the Church of England. And those disputes have to do with a lot of people in England feeling that the church was uncomfortably close to what they called popery, Catholicism. Remember, the Church of England had been created by Henry VIII and his dispute. That's another whole story. But the idea being that for lots and lots of people in the British Isles, the Church of England was too involved with pomp, with bishops who wore mitred hats, was too similar to Catholicism. Now, some of the people who wanted to purify the church from within who wanted to change the Church of England and to bring it more in line with traditional Calvinism, with the more radical forms of Lutheran Reformation, those people became known as Puritans. That was a kind of an insult thrown at them initially. They're Puritans, meaning not that they are so pure themselves, or claim to be so pure, but that they want to purify the church. Then there was another group, a much smaller group, known as Separatists. How small? Well, the Separatists that are important to us, that group that later became known as the Pilgrims, the Scrooby Separatists, do you know that historians say that this entire group of people, this entire movement within England, never numbered more than about 1,000 people? And yet, their impact on the American imagination, if not on American history, has been absolutely phenomenal. Most people learned in school something about how the Separatists, who they lived up in Scrooby Manor, which is in Nottinghamshire. Remember the Sheriff of Nottingham, Sherwood Forest, Robin Hood? It's in that part of England. And they weren't particularly wealthy. They were middle-class people, most of them yeoman farmers. And a number of the leaders actually went to jail. Over what? Over not attending the Church of England as they were supposed to do, out of starting their own separate congregation, meeting in people's homes. And the basic complaint of the Scrooby Separatists and of all Separatists with the Church of England was this. Who's head of the Church of England? By definition, it's the King or the Queen of England. The Separatists maintained that the real head of the church must be, and can only be, Jesus himself. And so, with all kinds of persecution falling on these people in the very early years of the 1600s, they decided to run away, to leave England en masse, to leave behind everything that they had known because their Christian conscience demanded it. Now, understand, when they went initially to Holland, they didn't do so to try to change the world, to try to be part of a mass movement, to try to create some kind of utopian colony that would then reform everybody. They did so because they felt they had no choice. This was what you had to do if you were going to follow your conscience and avoid being thrown into prison by persecutions by the Church of England. So they head out to Holland, arrive in Amsterdam. And you know what? You know the reputation Amsterdam has today? I mean, sort of noted for prostitution and drug running. The reputation of Amsterdam in the early 1600s wasn't much better. All of a sudden, these pious people arrive in Sin City. Well, it wasn't according to their expectations. And their travels, their pilgrimage, was actually only beginning. They came to Amsterdam because Amsterdam was famous, and Holland in general, the Netherlands in general, were famous for religious toleration. You could do anything you wanted there, and the government wouldn't interfere with you. But there was another reason they came, which is that Holland and the Netherlands had been struggling against the Spanish Catholics for years, and it was identified as a bulwark of an uncompromising sort of Protestant Christianity, the Dutch Reformed Church, that these Separatists, as they were called, felt would be much more hospitable to their vision of Christianity than what was going on with what they saw as the utterly corrupt and irredeemable Church of England back home. The problem is that once they arrived at Amsterdam, they saw that though the Dutch could be very fervently religious indeed, the city, Amsterdam, was not at all. It was a city, a seaport city, that even then was famous for its prostitution, was famous for its alehouses. They estimated there were 500 alehouses in the town of Amsterdam alone. And so all of a sudden, these very pious and fervent believers are saying, "What are we doing here?" Within a year of their arrival in 1607 and 1608, they decided to move again, to pack up everything they had, now rather meager possessions because they didn't have time to establish themselves financially in Amsterdam, and to move to a much smaller city, the university city of Leiden. In Leiden, they got work as weavers. They earned enough money to support themselves and to raise their kids, but they continued to be terribly, terribly worried about their children growing up. What's fascinating about this is there was another group of separatists who had come into Holland about 15 years before the Scrooby separatists. Other people who had rejected the Church of England, other people who had a much more pure and idealistic vision of Christianity, called the Ancient Brethren. And what the pilgrims saw is that the Ancient Brethren, after 20 years in Holland, had basically fallen apart. The kids had been seduced by the commercial culture of the Dutch. The kids were learning the Dutch language. And all of a sudden, another idea began to generate a great deal of enthusiasm from some of the more daring leaders of this tiny little group. The idea was the wild idea of heading out to Virginia. Now, I have to understand, I know a lot of people today who view Virginia as the center of the earth and covering basically all of the planet. But in those days, when people used the term Virginia, they were referring to everything between Florida and Canada. And that was all Virginia. What happened here was the idea of getting away from the contaminations of this world, from the persecutions of the Church of England, from the seductions of a very commercial, very materialistic culture in Holland, all of a sudden became very appealing. The problem was, how do you pay for such a voyage? Because in those days, traveling across the ocean, especially if you're going to have some equipment, was tremendously expensive. And these were not, by any means, wealthy people.
Coming up after the break, the separatists looked across the Atlantic for a new land and a new opportunity.
They bought a ship, the Speedwell. Boy, were they excited. I hate to say it, but the Speedwell did not exactly live up to its name.
Stay with us for more of this special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review when we return.
Are we going to have a prayer? It's Thanksgiving, you know. Before we're served, shouldn't we say grace?
In the year 1621, the pilgrims held their first Thanksgiving feast. They invited the great Indian chief, Massasoit, who brought 90 of his brave Indians and a great abundance of food. Governor William Bradford and Captain Miles Standish were honored guests. Elder William Brewster, who was a minister, said a prayer that went something like this. We thank God for our homes and our food and our safety in a new land. We thank God for the opportunity to create a new world with freedom and justice.
Amen.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. With the separatists discontented and somewhat disillusioned by life in the Netherlands, the idea of flight from Europe across the Atlantic gained significant appeal. Here's Michael Medved with the Pilgrim's Pursuit of the New World.
So with the approval of John Robinson, who was the charismatic leader and apparently a brilliant preacher, somebody who would deliver three-hour sermons and people wouldn't even stir. Now, you've got to be a brilliant preacher to be able to do that. John Robinson and others began talking about the possibility of this entire congregation that had gone from England to Amsterdam, from Amsterdam to Leiden, now making its way to the New World where they could pursue their godly path without interference and without compromise. How do you get money for it? Well, you apply to a bunch of investors, to businessmen who might like the idea of exploiting a bunch of fanatics like this. Now, understand, there was something called the Virginia Company, which had backed the colony of Jamestown with disastrous financial results. The problem with the colony of Jamestown was the people who came over to the first settlement in Virginia in 1607 were basically a bunch of thugs. They were selfishly motivated. There were very few idealists, very few competent people in the group. They thought they would find gold in Virginia. No such luck. The colony struggled and struggled and struggled, but never made any money for the investors. But all of a sudden, these separatists writing from Holland send a letter to the Virginia Company saying, hey, look, we're your guys. You should use us. Give us some money and we'll make you some more money back. And in the letter, they gave the reasons for why it would be such a good investment. They said, we are well weaned from the delicate milk of our mother country and inured to the difficulties of a strange and hard land, which yet, in a great part, we have by patience overcome. In other words, we've already made it in Holland, so we can make it in this howling wilderness as well. Secondly, they said, the people are, for the body of them, as industrious and frugal, we think we may safely say, as any company of people in the world. By the way, that was true. Then they go forward and they say, we are knit together as a body, in a most strict and sacred bond and covenant of the Lord, of the violation whereof we make great conscience, and by virtue whereof do we hold ourselves straitly tied to all care of each other's good, and of the whole by everyone, and so mutually. In other words, we can stick together, no fighting among ourselves. Lastly, it is not with us as with other men, whom small things can discourage, or small discontentments cause to wish themselves at home again. The Virginia Company was on the verge of bankruptcy because of the adventure in Jamestown. They didn't put forward the money, but another group of people who were connected with them, led by a bit of a rogue named Thomas Weston, were willing to put forward the money. But here was the deal. Try to imagine this. The deal was that anybody who could invest £10 would have one share of final profits. And each one of the pilgrims who went forward and crossed the ocean and labored for 7 years would also get one share. So what they were saying was 7 years of your work across the ocean in a dangerous wilderness is going to be worth £10. The deal was made. They began planning. They bought a ship, the Speedwell. Boy, were they excited. I hate to say it, but the Speedwell did not exactly live up to its name. It was a craft of some 60 tons, and it was supposed to take them across the Atlantic Ocean. And you can imagine people standing on the dock and looking out and watching the ship get smaller and smaller and then disappear from sight. Well, that ship didn't get very far. It was the Speedwell, remember. This was the 60-ton ship that they had bought. What a wreck. The Speedwell met up with the Mayflower. That was another ship that had been provided for the purpose. The Mayflower was from London. That was a ship, much bigger ship. It's a ship of 180 tons. It's a remarkably small ship when you think about 100 people jammed into it. But it was certainly bigger than the Speedwell. It was also more seaworthy. They sailed from London and cleared Southampton and got out about 100 leagues into sea when all of a sudden the Speedwell began to sink. This wasn't a good sign. So they turned around and they came back to Plymouth. In Plymouth, they spoke to a number of ship repair people, said, what can you do to fix up this tub? And they said, well, it's going to cost you a pretty penny. And they didn't have any money. So they applied to Thomas Weston. Remember, he was the investor behind this thing. He was supposed to be money for it. Said, look, we need to repair this ship. He said, are you kidding? Sell your provisions. So they took some of the provisions they had on barrels on board to help them get through the first winter, and they sold the provisions, particularly a whole bunch of butter and other dairy products that they were supposed to take along for the journey. They sold them. They got the repairs made. They set out again, now with less provisions. And once again, the Speedwell was a disaster. And they decided, well, you're going to have to make it on the Mayflower or not at all. This actually was an excuse for a number of people to say, you know what, maybe this voyage isn't such a great idea. Finally, when they did set sail, on September 16th, 1620, the wrong time to leave, it's getting to be autumn, they were supposed to be crossing during the summer, almost everybody had chickened out except for 35. That's all. The other people on board were either crew members or strangers, people who came along to make barrels or to make beer like John Alden, or just came along because they were adventurers. 35 pilgrims heading across the sea into nothing and nowhere. An amazing adventure, one of the greatest in human history. There's one name with this little pilgrim band that nobody has heard of, but it's a name that deserves the reputation of true hero. The name is Christopher Jones. Christopher Jones, who was that? He was the captain of the Mayflower. He wasn't a particularly religious man, But he was a remarkably decent one, and he was so inspired by the devotion and the faith of the men, women, and children, those 35 true believers. He was so moved by their devotion and their faith that he was unusually kind to them. For one thing, he offered, though he was captain of the ship, to bunk with his petty officers and gave his cabin to the women and small children of the Pilgrim brand. The rest of everybody else on board the Mayflower, on a surging, turbulent, miserable autumn ocean through September and October, those 102 people were huddled in lantern-lit darkness between decks, often sick, often dealing with stench, no chance really to cook any meals, eating things like salt pork, not tremendously appetizing even under the best of circumstances. And these pilgrims were also forced to endure another ordeal, and that was harassment from the sailors. Several of the crew began mocking them unmercifully, and their self-appointed leader had taken such a strong distaste for these pilgrims that he would laugh particularly at their seasickness. He would tell them how much he looked forward to the day when he could sew them up in shrouds and feed them to the fishes. To him, these voyagers were psalm-singing puke stockings. But just at the very peak of his tormenting, this very same crewman suddenly took ill of an unknown fever, and he died in a day. Nobody else caught the disease, and his body was the first one that was sewed into a shroud and tossed over the side to feed the fishes. After that, nobody mocked the pilgrims. That was the end of that.
Coming up, the Pilgrim's spirit and interchange with the Indians.
Have you got any beer?
The Town Hall Review will be right back. Welcome back to a special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The Pilgrim leader William Bradford liked to make a parallel of the journey of the separatists across the Atlantic to that of Israel in the pursuit of the Promised Land. As it was for Israel, the journey of the separatists across the ocean was also a costly journey. Many who left did not make their way ashore in Cape Cod in what is now Massachusetts. Here's Michael Medved.
But meanwhile, at long last, they arrive. Now, they were supposed to arrive in New York. It wasn't called New York then. It was, however, called Manhattan Island. They arrived at Cape Cod. The problem was, this clearly was no place to build a colony. It was too windy, it was too desolate, it was too miserable. So a group of men left the bulk of the people behind. They finally find what later became the harbor of Plymouth. So they got back to the Mayflower, only to find that William Bradford, one of the men who had been leading this expedition, discovered that his wife, Dorothy, it is said in the records, had fallen overboard and drowned. Nearly everyone who has read these accounts assumes that staring at this strange, wild, inhospitable, freezing, grim land, missing home and family and warmth and security, she had thrown herself overboard. But there was no time to mourn. The Mayflower went over back to Plymouth, this land that they had found, this mysteriously cleared land. They had even found some corn stored in a metal pot, which could help to keep them alive. The winter coming on, they immediately began trying to build some shacks for themselves, some protection, to determine what kind of food they could find. They didn't have enough supplies to last the winter. And in fact, in the winter ahead, half of them died. Finally, when they were able to count the losses, of the 102 people who had crossed the ocean, 47 had died. The biggest toll, the most painful toll, was by March, 13 of 18 wives had died. What those wives had died doing was protecting their children, because the children fared best. All seven daughters lived, and 10 of the 13 sons lived. And somehow, they kept their hopes up, and they kept alive, partially through coming up every Sunday to meet at the meeting house from the little huts they had built separately, listening to the preaching of William Brewster, who assured him that somehow this was all God's will. But finally, by the middle of March, things began to look a bit better. There was one particular day in the middle of March. It was a Friday. It was fair, the sky was blue, and they always looked back on that day as a key turning point when they saw a tall, muscular Indian wearing only a loincloth walking toward them. They shouted out, "Indian coming! Indian coming!" And they approached, carrying their firearms. But as he drew within range, this Indian shouted out in perfect English, "Welcome!" It was a deep, resonant voice. Then they replied, "Welcome." And then, in a fateful interchange, the next word from the Indian is, "Have you got any beer?" Well, the pilgrims didn't have any beer. And what do you say? This Indian walks in from nowhere. He looks pretty intent on his beer. What they say is, "Our beer is gone. Would you like some brandy?" And the answer, to no one's surprise, was, "You betcha." It turns out that this particular Indian is named Samoset, and he had developed both his English language skills and his taste for beer in contact with a number of the English fishermen who had sailed up and down along the New England coast. And now he told the pilgrims some fascinating news. The reason that they had been able to establish their settlement in Plymouth where they had is because this was land that had once belonged to the Patuxet tribe. The Patuxet had all died about 6 months before the pilgrims arrived. The nearest tribe was under command of a big chief named Massasoit, and Massasoit, or Massasoit, was a couple of days' journey away if you took your time. What Samoset said that was so particularly interesting is there was a Christian Indian, again, who spoke perfect English, who was living with Massasoit. And soon, as the spring wore on, that Indian, whose name was Squanto, Tisquantum was his actual Indian name, he's known to history as Squanto, he, when he met the pilgrims, changed everything. Everything.
Coming up.
Guess who's coming to dinner in Plymouth in 1621? It's Massasoit. Oh, yeah, with 90 of his braves. Let me tell you, those guys came with an appetite.
The Town Hall Review will be right back. Welcome back to a special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The history of relations between the Pilgrims and the Native American Indians certainly has many unfortunate and even tragic episodes, but there's also much to be said for the positive and fruitful relations between those two peoples. Michael Medved picks up on what the Pilgrims clearly saw as an act of God's providence in the meeting of Squanto.
As William Bradford declared in his own recollections, this Indian, Squanto, was a special instrument sent of God for their good beyond their expectation. He directed them how to set their corn, where to take fish, and to procure other commodities, and was also their chief pilot to bring them to unknown places for their profit, and never left them till he died. Squanto's story really begins in 1605. Now, we don't know exactly when he was born, but we know that by 1605 he was a teenager. And he was out hunting with his fellow Native Americans, fellow Indians, when a miserable excuse for a human being named Thomas Hunt, a one-time colleague of John Smith of Virginia and a sea captain, this Thomas Hunt spotted them. They captured them and clapped them into irons and took them with other Indians they collected to make money by selling them as slaves. Squanto was taken prisoner. He was made into a slave and he was brought to England, where he worked as a slave, worked as a servant, and lived there in England for 9 years. And as slaves could at the time, he saved little bits of this and that. He worked on his own, and finally he was able to buy his way, partially to talk his way, into freedom. He met Captain John Smith. Right, that same Captain John Smith of Jamestown, the guy with Pocahontas famously. John Smith was getting together a new voyage in 1614 to go back to New England, which of course is where Squanto came from. So Squanto asked if he could get on that voyage and go back to his people. Captain Smith, for a price, of course, agreed. And so Squanto headed back home. He was reunited with his family. He was reunited with his villagers, but his happiness didn't last because as soon as Captain Smith departed, again, another ship came along, a British ship, with a captain who began capturing slaves. And this time, he wasn't fortunate enough to be taken in slavery to England. He was taken to Spain, and that was much, much worse. It was a disaster, in fact, because the Spanish were known as the most cruel slave masters of that era. His friends were sold to North Africa. So just before they were about to sell Squanto to go to North Africa, where he unquestionably would have worked out the rest of his short life, and life was short for slaves in that circumstance, some Catholic friars appeared on the scene. And these Catholic friars had mercy and they had compassion. The friars were able to buy and rescue a few of the Indian slaves who were there for sale, including Squanto. So he went to live with the friars in a monastery, and they made him into a Christian. He accepted Christ and became a Christian believer. Now, he never was a particularly well-educated Christian, but he learned to speak perfect English and perfect Spanish. He learned to pray every day and became, at least on one level, quite devout. And with the help of these friars who had befriended him and were impressed by his fine mind and his remarkable character, he got enough money to pay for his voyage back to the New World. Second time going back to that village that he had left, the Pawtuxet village in what is today Massachusetts. He finally arrived just a few months before the pilgrims got there. He landed in Massachusetts, walked back to his village, and he found it absolutely deserted. He heard the news then that everyone had all died. In deepest melancholy, Squanto went to live with Massasoit. He had been living with him for several months when Massasoit came in April of 1621 to meet the pilgrims, and Squanto came along. Try to think about this for a moment. I mean, the chances of finding a fervently Christian Indian who would provide them with help. And with the harvest that they planted, and with the summer going forward, they actually were doing much better. They were happy enough at the end of the spring and the summer of their planting to want to celebrate their survival and the fact that things were looking up. And so they called a day of Thanksgiving, and they invited Chief Massasoit. That seemed like a politic thing to do. They had enough to serve. They actually caught some wild fowl, apparently. They had some vegetables that they had grown. They had some corn. But the problem is, when Massasoit arrived for this feast, which we don't know exactly the date, but it was sometime in October of 1621, the first Thanksgiving, when Massasoit arrived, it's sort of, guess who's coming to dinner in Plymouth in 1621? It's Massasoit, oh yeah, with 90 of his braves. Let me tell you, those guys came with an appetite. This wasn't tremendously good news for the four only women who had to provide for all these guys. Before these four women who had to cook for this crowd completely despaired, Massasoit showed that the braves came along with a bunch of dressed deer. Now, this added greatly to the bill of fare, which we know included cod, sea bass. Wouldn't that be interesting if we had a traditional sea bass for Thanksgiving? Wild fowl, including ducks, geese, turkeys, and swans, cornmeal, and probably some wheat, and then those five deer brought by the Indians. Cranberries, maybe. Cranberry sauce, They didn't have sugar to make the cranberry sauce that we enjoy today. Popcorn, that's just a story. This wasn't the kind of corn that lent itself for popping. One of the mistakes that people make about the pilgrims is they assume that they were Quakers, pacifists, wearing black, rejecting the ways of the world. Or otherwise, people sometimes think of them as Mennonites or Amish. They were none of these things. I mean, for one thing, they wore bright colors. They did not wear all dark clothes. They did not wear all conical hats with buckles on them. In fact, they didn't wear buckles at all. How do we know what they wore? Well, partially because, well, of wills that people left behind with their clothing in it specified. Not only did they enjoy wearing colors, but they were by no means pacifists. Miles Standish was the commander of the full armed might of the Plymouth colony, 16 armed men. They used that armed might. They loved their guns. They, in fact, brought their guns with them to divine worship, did leave them outside, but associated guns with celebration, with the Sabbath. In other words, these people were not only the Christian right of the time, and so they were perceived, they were also gun nuts, big time. Remember the description of the first Thanksgiving in 1621? What did they do with the Indians? They shot off their guns. And that was something of the way that you expressed enjoyment or celebration.
Coming up,
the Pilgrims, much more popular to the current day because they were underdogs.
Stay with us for the final segment of the Town Hall Review. Welcome back to a special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review. I'm Hugh Hewitt. For how remarkably few they were and the fact that they were of genuinely humble means, the Pilgrims have retained a very special place in the imagination of Americans. In one respect, they foreshadowed an American exceptionalism that gives us both pride of purpose and a quiet humility in recognition of how indebted we are to this day to divine favor. Here's Michael on the gun-toting, God-loving Pilgrims.
When we look at the achievements of both Puritans and Pilgrims, we are amazed. Why, then, were they so hard on themselves? Some 60 years after the founding of Massachusetts, all that you heard from preachers and from scholars was how far short they had fallen of the goals of founders like John Winthrop. Cotton Mather, writing three generations after the founding of the colony, said that religion begat prosperity and the daughter devoured the mother. In other words, we had become just another rich colony. Our purpose, reforming of the world, largely forgotten. It was never forgotten. The Puritan conscience could not be stilled. William Bradford, who lived for 37 years and led the Plymouth colony, the Pilgrim colony in Plymouth, felt the same sort of frustration. At the very end of his life, his last recorded words on Plymouth Plantation show that he was deeply frustrated that Plymouth had become just a mildly prosperous, normal town. But it wasn't just that. Both of these colonies gave America the gift of a higher demand, higher purpose, the notion that this country was founded for a reason. The Pilgrims, much more popular to the current day because they were underdogs. They were poor, they were few, they didn't really know what they were doing, and they came and many of them died, and yet they hung on and survived. The Puritans were simply too successful. They were well-born, they were well-organized, and they were corporate in their structure, people who knew what they were doing and what direction they wanted to go. There was something else, too. Remember, the Pilgrims were separatists. They could sort of make people comfortable with the idea that they were simply looking for religious refuge from persecution. There's something deeply American about that. That's why people always light out to the frontier. They want to be left alone. The Puritans didn't want to be left alone. They didn't want to leave the world alone. They changed the world. And that's the tension in America. Individual Americans wanting to be left alone and being thankful to God that they're able to survive. And yet these grand designs, like the Puritan design of Massachusetts, a design to purify humanity and to create a perfect commonwealth, both of those themes celebrated on Thanksgiving, part of the heritage of Massachusetts.
And that wraps up this edition of the Town Hall Review. Thanks for joining us for this special Thanksgiving edition of the Town Hall Review. I trust your holiday weekend is filled with rich times with family and loved one, and infused with the spirit of gratitude to God for the many blessings we enjoy in our great nation. For executive producer Russell Schumann and producers Derek Fowler and Dwayne Patterson, I'm Hugh Hewitt, inviting you to join us again next week for another edition of the Town Hall Review, the weekend news program from a perspective you can trust.